Hello, this is Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, February 7th, 2017. Brent Christensen's trial. Bloodstain allegedly in shape of handprint. Purported forensic evidence, recordings of suspect detailed in prosecutor's filings. Prosecutors said Wednesday that evidence of handprint-shaped bloodstains was found in the apartment of Brent Christensen, who is accused of kidnapping and killing visiting University of Illinois scholar Yingying Zhang. Ms. Zhang from China was last seen June 9, 2017, entering Christensen's car near a bus stop on campus and is presumed dead by the FBI. While Christensen told the FBI he let her out a few blocks away, prosecutors said shortly after he was arrested that they have tapes of Christensen describing how he kidnapped Ms. Zhang and carried her back to his apartment, how she fought and resisted against him, and how he restrained her. Now prosecutors say they have recordings that Christensen engaged in conduct that would result in her bleeding in the apartment. They also said Wednesday that evidence will show the defendant took extensive steps to clean the apartment after his alleged offense, thereby preventing confirmatory testing, but leaving trace amounts that were detected by the preliminary testing. Prosecutors said the identification, location, and pattern of the blood, including human handprints, were consistent with the defendant's own later recorded statements as to what occurred in the apartment. Prosecutors had Christensen's girlfriend wear a wire and surreptitiously record his conversations in the 2 weeks leading up to his arrest, June 30, 2017. Law enforcement also interviewed him twice before his arrest. U.S. attorneys were responding Wednesday to a motion filed by Christensen's lawyers in August seeking to exclude both certain blood tests and a hearing about the reliability of the DNA and blood testing used. A hearing is currently scheduled for Monday on that, as well as on the reliability of a cadaver-sniffing canine, which, according to the defense, alerted to the presence of a body in Christensen's bathroom. An FBI biologist will testify at trial that she identified Ms. Zhang's DNA in Christensen's bedroom and the possible presence of blood in his bedroom and bathroom, his lawyer said in August. The presence of blood was found but not confirmed with more testing on his mattress, bathroom sink trap, and bedroom wall and floor, Christensen's lawyers said. The presence of blood was confirmed on a piece of carpet and a piece of baseboard, they said. His lawyers want the unconfirmed results excluded from the trial, which is scheduled to begin in April. Prosecutors argued Wednesday that the blood tests don't need to be conclusive to be included at trial, but instead only need to make an important fact more or less probable. The result of the luminol testing in this case makes it more probable that blood was found in the defendant's apartment, they wrote, especially when considered with the DNA testing, Christensen's statement, and the blood location and pattern. They also argued that the blood testing has been a standard confirmatory test for blood for over 100 years, and that every court to have considered the issue has found that the DNA tests used are scientifically reliable and the results admissible. Because of this, they argued that Monday's hearing is unnecessary. In a related article, questions for potential jurors okayed. Queries range from knowledge about case to death penalty stance to what books they read. U.S. District Judge James Shadid approved on Wednesday a list of about 120 questions potential jurors will have to answer before deciding the fate of Brent Christensen, accused of kidnapping and killing visiting University of Illinois scholar Yingying Zhang. Their answers will help Shadid and the lawyers for both sides pick an impartial jury in April that they hope can fairly decide whether Christensen is guilty and, if so, whether he deserves the death penalty. The questions include everything from what books they like to read to what online dating apps they've used. Shadid mostly stuck with the questions previously agreed to, adding two requested by the defense and one by the prosecutors. These include, have you formed an opinion regarding the guilt or innocence of Mr. Christensen based on what you have seen, read, or heard? If yes, what is your opinion? Have you formed an opinion regarding the appropriate punishment for Mr. Christensen's based on what you have read, seen, heard, or discussed? If yes, what is your opinion? Which of the following best describes your feelings about the death penalty? The eight possible answers given range from complete opposition to the death penalty to no opinion to strongly in favor of capital punishment. The answers to these and to other questions will help determine whether a potential juror should be disqualified from serving. Potential jurors who would automatically vote for or against the death penalty must be disqualified, Shadid wrote Wednesday. During jury selection, which is also called voir dire, each side gets to argue to Shadid that certain jurors should be stricken for cause. Then they also each should get to strike 20 jurors without cause. The purpose of the questionnaire is to identify and disqualify those who are plainly unable to be impartial and also to elucidate the views and opinions of those who remain, Shadid wrote. In this respect, the questionnaires assist the court and counsel with the task of deciding which of those in the veneer would be struck for cause, inform counsel as to potential topics for follow-up questions during individual voir dire, and guide counsel's later decision to exercise a peremptory challenge. Many of the questions are obviously relevant, such as whether the potential jurors know anyone involved in the case and if they have any ailments that would affect their ability to serve. But others are seemingly unrelated, including, would you consider yourself to be a leader? Have you ever made posts to YouTube, Reddit, or other such sites? And how often do you attend a place of worship? Lawyers can't strike a juror because of their race or gender, so the many questions can give lawyers a race or gender-neutral question for doing this. Shadid denied the defense's request to have potential jurors fill out the questionnaires at the courthouse in Peoria, where the trial is going to be. Because he didn't include some of the sensitive questions the defense wanted to include in the questionnaire, he said filling them out at the courthouse wouldn't be necessary. Instead, potential jurors will fill out the questionnaires online if they receive a jury summons in the mail. Now the court has to decide how the jury will be selected after they fill out their questionnaires. Jury selection is scheduled to begin April 1st and could last several days to several months. In a motion filed early Wednesday evening, prosecutors argued for potential jurors to be questioned as part of a panel instead of individually, as the defense has asked for. In some federal capital cases cited by prosecutors, jury selection has ranged from as short as 3 days to as long as more than 4 months. 91st Academy Awards, Cause of Effects. U of I alumnus being honored again for his pioneering work in light stage technology. When Paul Debevic was young, his grandfather gave him a Super 8 camera for Christmas. He liked to make those little stop-action movies, Mom Linda Miller said, recalling one was of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich being made and a glass of milk being poured. The sandwich gets eaten and the milk goes down, but you never see any hands. She starred in another movie that required her to sit in an old office chair in their backyard. He acted like he was starting it lawnmower, said Miller, who grew a bit annoyed when he kept directing her to stand up, move the chair a short distance, and sit back down across the entire yard while he filmed her. But she was impressed with the results. It looked like I was self-propelled. Perhaps that fascination and experimentation with cameras, computers, photography, and movie making, all of which started around age 7 or 8, is why the Champagne woman isn't that surprised her son would go on to innovate in the field of computer-generated graphics and help advance special effects in the filmmaking industry. The 1988 University Laboratory High School alumnus led a team at the University of Southern California's Institute for Creative Technologies that developed groundbreaking light stage technology used to help create realistic digital humans and human-like characters in Avatar, The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, Blade Runner 2049, and many more award-winning Hollywood busters. Now a senior scientist at Google VR, his work will be honored by the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences on Saturday. It will be his second Academy Award. In 2010, Debevic, along with Timothy Hopkins, John Monos, and Mark Sager, picked up a scientific and engineering award called the Academy Plaque for designing and engineering earlier versions of the light stage capture device devices and the image-based facial rendering system developed for character relighting in motion pictures. I was over the moon, recalled Miller, a licensed clinical social worker who used to work at the University of Illinois McKinley Health Center, but is now in private practice. She added she was thrilled but not surprised to learn he will be honored a second time at this year's Scientific and Technical Awards ceremony at the Beverly Wilshire in Beverly Hills. Academy certificates recognizing technical achievement will be given to Debevic Timothy Hawkins and Wan Chu Ma for the invention of the polarized spherical gradient illumination facial appearance capture method, and Zhum Yu for the design and engineering of the Light Stage 10 capture system. I don't know that it came as a surprise, because I know how hard he works, said Miller, who is flying to Los Angeles this morning to join her son and his colleagues at the Black Tie event. He does very good work, and he's a perfectionist. It's hard for someone who's an academic, not in the film industry, to garner an award like this. So I'm so happy his work is being rewarded and recognized. Born in Princeton, New Jersey, Debevic was 5 years old when his family moved to Champaign in 1977. His dad, Paul T. Debevic, now a U of I professor emeritus of nuclear and particle physics, also recalls that his son showed an interest in computers at an early age. At Southside Elementary School, he learned how to write programs in BASIC on a TRS-80 and Apple II computers in a computer van that traveled around to different schools. By age 9 or 10, he used his earnings from his News Gazette paper route to buy his own Commodore VIC-20 computer. Even as a junior high school student, I remember him writing a graphics program so someone's name could spin around in 3D, his dad said, incredulously, quickly adding that computer ability didn't come from him. The younger Debevic said it wasn't until he went to the University of Michigan to study math and computer engineering that he realized he could turn his interest in computer graphics into a career. In the summer of 1991, he devised a method of transforming a digitized picture of his 11-year-old Chevette, a hand-me-down from Mom, to create an animation of it flying across the screen. At the University of California, Berkeley, he worked with his doctoral advisor to create an image-based modeling system for creating virtual cinematography of architectural scenes using new techniques for photogrammetry and image-based rendering, and later directed a photorealistic fly-around of the Bell Tower on campus for his 1997 film, The Campanile Movie. Those techniques were later used to create Oscar-winning virtual backgrounds in the bullet time shots in the 1991 blockbuster The Matrix. Debevic said the development of the Light Stage system to create realistic digital humans and characters originated from his postdoc research at Berkeley and carried over to his work at USC's Institute of Creative Technologies, where he led graphics research for 16 years, and Neil is an adjunct research professor of computer science. A prototype was made out of wood, plastic tubing, and a 250-watt spotlight, which was pulled with ropes to move the light. It was very low tech, but it could light a face from every direction that the light could come from. Prior to 2004, Debevic said the only way he got a really high-resolution model of an actor's face, which special effects people could use to change a character into a creature, age the character, and make it look realistic, was to make a plastic cast, photograph it, and put the photos in a high-resolution laser scanning system, which was expensive and time-consuming. The early technology was used in a few films, including Spider-Man 2, released in 2004, Superman Returns, 2006, and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, 2008, where it was used to age Brad Pitt's character. Both Spider-Man 2 and Benjamin Button won Oscars for the best visual effects. Then around 2005, Debevic said he started working on an advanced system using polarizing filters on the lights and cameras to polarize out the specular reflection from every lighting direction simultaneously. The new technology gave us a quick photographic process, to get that tenth of a to get that tenth of a millimeter detail of the skin in a way we could run through a series of natural facial expressions to record every way that the actor can look and everything they can do with their face. Debevec said the technology has been used in 40 films, including Avatar and Blade Runner 2049, both of which won the Visual Effects Oscar for 2009 and 2017, respectively. He said that for him, one of the most meaningful times it has been used was in Furious 7 from the Fast and the Furious franchise. He said about half of the movie had been shot when Paul Walker, one of the stars, was killed in a car accident. Production shut down, and it looked like it might be the end of the franchise, he said. But the director, with the help of Walker's family, decided to finish the film. Debevec's team scanned the late actor's brothers Caleb and Cody Walker, and Weta Digital, Peter Jackson's visual effects company, used the data to create a very credible digital likeness that was used in the rest of Walker's scenes. Though he's still involved in USC's ICT, Debevec has been working with Lightfield Technology to improve the quality of Google's VR headset, among other things, as a senior scientist with the company. With Lightfields, we'll build some custom camera rigs that can use additional cameras and move them around in a spherical space, and we record all the rays of light coming into the spherical space, he said, adding it will be more realistic and comfortable to the user. He is also working on a new light stage for Google. Stay tuned to see what we're doing with that, he said. Meantime, he's looking forward to taking his mom to Saturday's ceremony. Miller was also his plus one in 2010, the big Oscars ceremony a couple of years later, and other events where her son has been honored. In 2001, he received SIGGRAPH's first significant New Researcher Award, and in 2017, he won the Progress Medal, the most prestigious award handed out by the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. Debevec expects Saturday's ceremony to be fun. It's held a couple of weeks before the 91st Oscars at the Dolby Theater in Hollywood and has been hosted by A-listers such as Jessica Alba, Margot Robbie, and Patrick Stewart in the past. A couple of years after winning his first Oscar, Debevec was asked to sit on the Academy's Science and Technology Council. As part of that, I've gotten to go every year for the last 6 years, he said, adding he termed off last year. I pretty much had to win an award if I wanted to go. Let the storm roll on. Big Ten, unlike other leagues, it's okay to rush the court. As the clock ticked down on the Illinois 79-74 upset over Michigan State on Tuesday night, jubilant Illini fans poured onto the court, surrounding players who chest-bumped and raised their arms in triumph. The same scenario played out Friday when the Iowa Hawkeyes upended number 2 Michigan. It's a long-standing college tradition and all legal under Big Ten rules. While some athletic conferences prohibit fans from rushing the court, field or court, and fine schools when it happens, the Big Ten has no policy on it. Neither does Illinois. There is no policy in place and therefore no fine, said Jason Yellen, Assistant Big Ten Commissioner for Communications. The post-game situations are managed locally by the institutions themselves. That's up to them if they want to do something. From a conference perspective, there are no policies prohibiting it. The SEC has had a ban in place since 2004, but the penalties were raised in 2015 to $50,000 for a first offense, up to $100,000 for a second offense, and up to $250,000 for the third and subsequent offenses, said spokesman Herb Vincent. SEC officials have said the fines are meant as a deterrent to protect the safety of students, players, coaches, and fans. Kentucky was fined $100,000 in September when football fans stormed the field after the Wildcats upset Mississippi State. Similarly, LSU football was fined $100,000 in October after defeating Georgia, and Texas A&M was fined $50,000 after a big win over LSU in November, Vincent said. The Big 12 also has penalties for schools who fail to control fans. Last month, Texas Tech was fined $25,000 and reprimanded by the Big 12 for violating sportsmanship standards when fans stormed the court after a basketball win over number 2 West Virginia. A West Virginia player was also reprimanded for striking a Texas Tech fan, according to news reports. The practices led to verbal altercations between coaches and opposing fans, and even injuries. In 2016, Des Moines Register columnist Randy Peterson suffered a broken leg when Iowa State fans rushed the court after a last-second win against rival Iowa. Two more students arrested. State pair fled after first fight. Two more Urbana High School freshmen identified as being involved in a gang-related brawl Monday at the school have been criminally charged with mob action. The boys, each 15, appeared Wednesday in juvenile court, where Judge Tom DeFontis ordered that they be held in the juvenile detention center at least until their February 15th status hearings. DeFontis also appointed lawyers for each of the teens. State's attorney Julia Reitz laid out the same facts for DeFontis on Wednesday as she did for Judge Heidi Ladd on Tuesday in the cases of 6 co-defendants. Reitz said Urbana police learned that a series of fights Monday morning at school were a continuation of a fight between 7 members of the Oh My Brother gang against 3 members of an unnamed rival group. The two boys arraigned Monday had fled the school Monday after the main brawl near and inside the cafeteria that resulted in a teacher being injured. They were found at their homes Tuesday afternoon and arrested. Reitz said one boy admitted his role in the fight, while the other refused to talk to police on the advice of his mother's boyfriend. The boy who refused to cooperate had 2 prior police contacts, Reitz said. DeFontis explained to both boys that they face penalties upon conviction, ranging from probation to up to 3 years in prison. Meantime, Urbana police continue to look for others they believe were identified in the fighting. Police said there were no problems at the school Wednesday. Campus conversation. Julie Worth's occasional chat with the University of Illinois newsmaker. More than 600,000 Americans are expected to die from cancer this year, and 1.7 million people will be diagnosed with the disease. The new cancer center at Illinois, which has pulled together more than 70 cancer researchers across campus, wants to make a dent in those numbers and improve the way patients are diagnosed and treated. With a unique approach based on engineering and technology advances, it hopes to win designation as a National Cancer Institute and attract funding and expertise to campus. Founding director Rohit Bhargava talked about the center's plans and what it meant for the community in this week's campus conversation. A sampling. Why is the National Cancer Institute designation important? There are 70 cancer centers that are designated by NCI, and 63 of them deal with clinical operations of some sort. And then there are 7 centers that really focus on the science and understanding cancer. Purdue University and MIT in Boston are basic cancer science centers. They're very interested in understanding how the mechanism of cancers might help us to design better drugs, for example, or better imaging techniques. We hope to be a basic science center and be the 8th one in the nation to be designated by NCI. The last basic science cancer center was designated almost 28 years ago, so this would be a tremendous advance for the country. And actually, there is no basic science center that is focused on technology and engineering. Technology is really now at a point where it can be applied at a mass scale into problems that we weren't even thinking of a while ago. You said the designation could bring in $10 million of federal funding over the first 5 years and help attract top scientists to campus. If you are a cancer researcher and you want to do really exciting work, would you go to an NCI designated cancer center or would you go somewhere else? That's the advantage that the destination process has. So in this environment, it is much easier to recruit people who are interested in the kind of science that we're doing. We have the plan set up, we have the right standards, we have national recognition, so they will come. And we want to take our technology into the clinics. If you talk to people who are trying to move technology, it takes 10 to 15 years to set up the whole agreement by yourself, to find the right collaborations to make sure you're supported to do institutional agreements. That's what the Cancer Center can do. It can greatly accelerate that process so that individuals who are not spending our time doing paperwork. Instead, we're focusing on research. So instead of a 10-year horizon, we're maybe looking at a 3-year horizon or a 5-year horizon. And that really is the payoff for the university and our community, is moving things faster from basic research to actual use. We all need a better way in cancer research. Two girls accuse man of sexual abuse. Alleged acts occurred from 2011 to January 2nd. Tuscola. A 58-year-old Tuscola man could spend the rest of his life in prison if convicted of sexually molesting two young girls in his care. Douglas County State's Attorney Kate Watson said she charged Clyde Kearns following a girl's revelation, which came to light in late December, that he had allegedly committed a sex act with her. Watson said the child's mother came across something her daughter had written that prompted her to contact Tuscola police. Police learned that two girls, both under the age of 13, had allegedly been molested by Kearns in his Tuscola home when he babysat for them, Watson said. So the girls were interviewed by experts trained in dealing with child sex crimes. Kearns was charged January 22nd with 6 counts of predatory criminal sexual assault. 4 alleged sex acts that occurred with one girl between 2011 and May 2018, and 2 alleged acts that happened between February 2016 and January 2, 2019. Conviction of that crime normally carries penalties ranging from 6 to 60 years in prison, but if a defendant is convicted of offenses involving more than one victim, they must be sentenced to natural life in prison. Watson has filed 2 counts of aggravated criminal sexual abuse against Kearns, alleging different acts that occurred with one of the girls between May 19, 2018 and January 2nd of this year. Kearns was arrested January 22nd and remains in the Douglas County Jail in lieu of $300,000 bond. He is represented by public defender Jim Lee. Man may face prison for soliciting teen. A Champaign man convicted of trying to pay a teenage girl to have sex with him faces a maximum of 7 years in prison. A Champaign County jury on Wednesday convicted Jacinto Chavez, 43, in a 1300 block of Fairfax Drive of indecent solicitation of a child and obstructing identification for giving police a false name as they investigated the girl's allegations. The charges stemmed from activity that happened in August in the neighborhood where Chavez lived. A 15-year-old girl who also lived in that area testified that on August 22nd, a man approached her near her home and told her in a rather coarse manner that he wanted to have sex with her and asked her if she wanted to do it at his place or behind a house. She said he got out his wallet to show her money and wanted to show what her price was. The girl said she went inside her home while the man remained on the front step. She said her aunt came out and chased him away from the porch, where he had remained with his wallet out. She testified that when she saw him again August 25th on the sidewalk in the neighborhood, she informed family members and the police were called. Champaign officers found Chavez in the neighborhood. This has been Mary Mortland reading the News Gazette Part 1 for Thursday, February 7th, 2019. Please stay tuned for Part 2.